I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Martine Rothblatt. She's an attorney, bioethicist, and futurist. She's been a satellite communications pioneer and a global space law activist. She's the founder and chairwoman of the biotech firm United Therapeutics Corporation. She's the author of a classic in transgender law, The Apartheid of Sex, and is the author of a book on reproductive ethics called Unzipped Genes. Also a book on Middle East politics called Two Stars for Peace. She was the second guest, the very second guest on Change Surfer Radio back in 1988, and now serves on the board of directors of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Today we'll be talking about her most, one of her recent books called Your Life or Mine, and it's about xenotransplantation, which we'll unpack in a second. Now, you are a biotech and bioethics person, so xenotransplantation is certainly one of the issues that is hot in this field. But is there any personal reason that led you to be interested in the topic of organ transplantation and access to organs?
Sure. Well, thanks for asking, Jay, and I'm certainly very happy to be on Change Surfer Radio again. My personal interest in xenotransplantation evolved originally from my quest to come up with definitive treatments for pulmonary hypertension. And this is an illness that afflicts my youngest daughter. In fact, led me to start United Therapeutics to develop a pharmaceutical treatment. When all pharmaceutical treatments fail for pulmonary hypertension, the only remaining quote-unquote cure is a lung transplant. And I say quote-unquote cure because whenever you receive an organ transplant, to some extent you trade one disease for another. You trade the disease that got you into the problem leading to a need for an organ transplant for the disease of chronic organ rejection that for most people ultimately leads to a failure of the transplanted organ. Now, it's often possible to enable there to be a retransplant, a second organ transplant, but after that, surgeons just feel that the scarcity of organs is so great that they're not going to allow somebody to have more than two shots at an organ. And indeed, for most people, especially for lung transplants, they will never even get the first transplant because the supply of organs is far too small to handle the demand for them. I learned about the possibility of xenotransplantation, which is the transplantation of animal organs into people, and I saw that with xenotransplantation, there was a possibility for an endless number of retransplantations. As an organ was rejected, a new organ could be retransplanted, and hence one would be trading a disease for a true cure. And in addition to that, I further learned that the possibility of genetically modifying the animal organs before they were transplanted into the human body could greatly minimize the rejection problem. And so for both of these reasons, I began to look at xenografts, that's animal organs transplanted into people, as an ultimate cure for pulmonary hypertension. And it, because that disease afflicts my daughter, the quest to come up with a cure for it has been one of the major motivators for the past 15 years of my life.
Now, we'll get into some of the problems that people foresee and that you address in the book about xenotransplantation. But before one would take the step of xenotransplantation and its attendant risks, you would seem to want to explore all the options for increased organ donation and alternative sources of organs that we have available to us. One that I've long recommended is just to make our donor cards legally binding, because most people, when asked at, you know, when they get their driver's license or whatever, if they want to donate their organs, say yes. But the problem is that very few of the healthcare providers and the family members at the time when a person comes in and is a potential donor, that transaction doesn't take place for a variety of reasons. And so if you just made it legally binding, this guy has the organ donor card, therefore we get the organs, and you don't have to ask the family members, that would greatly increase our donation rates.
That's absolutely true, and it's certainly a move that I support, Jay. But what I point out in the book, in fact, in the very first chapter of Your Life or Mine, is that there are actually two views of demand for organs. The view that organs are scarce, but the scarcity is addressable through, marginal actions that can improve organ donation, is a view based on a very artificially constrained demand for organs. One that says, for example, people over the age of 60 are not even allowed to be on the list for organ transplants. And similar type of artificial restrictions. And it turns out that by requiring that organs be assumed to be transplantable upon death, unless somebody really opted out of that, or by having more efficient means of rescuing organs that are available as a result of automobile accidents and such things, one can end up addressing only about 1 or 2% of what I call the true demand for organs. And the true demand for organs is the demand measured by the number of people that die of organ failure, which is overwhelmingly people who die of heart failure. And as has been pointed out very well by a number of experts, there are something like 100,000 people a day worldwide who die of heart failure. And unfortunately, the number of organs which are in the argo of the field harvestable or capturable or retransplantable or donatable by virtue of automobile accidents or other types of trauma is just a small fraction of the percent needed to address the huge toll of people dying due to organ failure. Only something like artificially produced organs, regenerated organs from stem cells or xenografts could even in logic conceivably address the true demand for organs.
What about artificial, I mean, you addressed this, but just take us through the argument again. There are artificial organs being developed, and presumably the length of time for the rolling out of xenotransplanted pig organs or whatever, by the time they come out, we might have tissue engineering through stem cells, or we might have artificial hearts and livers and kidneys and so forth.
Sure. Well, first, I think that all means of developing alternative organs to be transplanted and save people's lives are good paths to pursue. And I strongly encourage all research into the three main different types of possibilities there, as you identify the artificial organs through biomechanical type of means, regenerated organs, or xenografts. However, of the three, it's pretty clear to me that the one which is most near-term in terms of availability and least expensive in terms of cost and therefore accessible to a much greater percentage of the world's population are xenografts. The reason for this is that we have right now, today, the ability to transplant miniature swine hearts, and that is the xenograft of choice. It's a type of pig, a very small pig, and it turns out that pig's heart is virtually the exact same dimensions and size as the human heart. And we already have the ability to transplant that pig's heart into humans and have it surmount hyperacute rejection, which was the first kind of showstopper phase of xenotransplantation, because these miniature swine hearts are from what are called transgenic swines. These pigs have been genetically modified so that their hearts do not express certain sugars that were the cause of hyperacute rejection. Phrased another way, transplanting a heart from one of these miniature swine causes no greater rejection problem in a recipient than transplanting a heart from another member of the same species of that recipient. And this work was so successful, Jay, that dozens of chimpanzees in research done in the UK received these transplanted transgenic porcine hearts and lived quite well with them up until the point in time when the protocols set forth by the animal care regulations in the UK required those chimpanzees to be put down.
Do they require immunosuppressive drugs?
Yes, they did require immunosuppressive drugs, but they were the same types of immunosuppressive drugs that are used today with thousands of people who receive kidney transplants and liver transplants.
To get away from immunosuppressive drugs, we would have to basically have the same genetic tissue. Or is the immune problem with organ transplantation specific to certain proteins that we might be able to engineer out of a transgenic heart, whereas we wouldn't be able to engineer it out of a cadaveric heart from a human donor?
Exactly. You have it exactly right. You could ultimately develop a transgenic heart, for example, that was in essence totally neutral to the immune system and would not give the immune system anything to grab a hold of and to reject. But I would hasten to add that that would be sort of like a very high level of success, but it would be a perfectly acceptable level of success just to use the porcine organs as they are today. And the reason for that is because the science of immunosuppression for what's called acute rejection and chronic rejection is very well understood. We accomplish tens of thousands of organ transplants every year, and organ transplant recipients live perfectly normal lives. As mentioned, over a course of depending on the organ and depending on the individual and depending on from whom they receive their graft, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, chronic rejection will eventually destroy the graft. But the beauty of using xenografts is that there's an unlimited supply of regrafts, so you could retransplant an individual.
I'm speaking with Martine Rothblatt. She's an entrepreneur, attorney, bioethicist, futurist, satellite communications expert. She has a variety of expertises. And this one, as as we talked about at the beginning, is one that she came through a very personal interest and has written a really remarkable book called Your Life or Mine, How Geoethics Can Resolve the Conflict Between Public and Private Interests in Xenotransplantation. Now, you mentioned the transgenic nature of these hearts, the fact that they've been genetically tweaked not to have some of the proteins that cause acute rejection from animal organs. President Bush, in his State of the Union address, argued that we should have a ban on human-animal hybrids, which I think he might include such a transgenic animal in. And many ethicists have expressed concerns not only about the hybridization and transgenic modification of animals, but animal rights issues here in general. And that's something that you address in Your Life or Mine. Why don't you take us through the argument and your solution to that argument?
Sure. Well, the fear of the Bush administration about hybridization of animals and humans, I find one certainly at odds with biology and history and therefore just a bit humorous, because all species are by definitions hybrids of all that has come before. All of us are part of a very deeply rooted biological tree, and therefore there are DNA sequences in our cells which we have in common with the most basic bacteria.
And which may have absorbed from unicellular organisms to begin with.
Exactly. So to say one is against hybridization is to say one is against life, and which I think they just don't understand what they're talking about. In terms of the hybridization feature of having an animal organ inside a human body, it would be really quite absurd for the Bush administration to be against this, because, for example, They are great advocates of immunization and urge seniors and whatnot to be immunized each year against the flu vaccine. And every time we do take this kind of an immunization, we are, in fact, making ourselves transspecies to some extent, because we are taking DNA or RNA fragments from viruses, which are usually cultured from ducks or pigs in China and other places where the flu arises, and intentionally injecting that into our body and modifying our immune system and our biochemistry based upon that. On top of that, people consume all manner of meat and vegetables, and all of that animal or plant essence ultimately forms the fiber and the essence of our body. So we're also part animal and part human in that regard. But that takes me to the last point you raised, Jim, and it's, Jay, is one that I too am very, very concerned about, which is the how do the animals feel about this and what are the animal rights aspects. And I myself am a vegetarian because I find it ethically problematic to kill animals that feel pain unnecessarily. However, as I point out in your life or mine, the value of these transgenic swine would be so high because they would literally be true life bearers to hundreds of thousands of people that it would behoove everyone involved to make sure that these transgenic swine were given very good lives. By the way, they normally live a life of about 3 to 4 years. So to give a very good life to them, to ensure that they have opportunities for social interaction. They need to remain in a clean place, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And then finally, when it is time to kill them and to take their organs, that they are not aware of this, that this be done through first anesthesia when they're sleeping, and so that they end their life without any pain.
Yeah, you can imagine that these transgenic swine would live better lives than, you know, Kobe beef in Japan being washed by beer every day. You know, that they would have the finest of medical care up to the very last minute.
Exactly. And I point out in the book that, in fact, in the United States alone, 100 million pigs are slaughtered each year simply for bacon. And these pigs live in the most horrid conditions in 99.99% of the cases. So if we can ethically countenance 100 million pigs being slaughtered for bacon, I think it's a much higher goal to have just 100,000 pigs who are cared for gently so that they can give life to other people. And finally, when they are sacrificed, it be in a manner which is totally ethical and of which they are completely unaware.
The control of their environment is also extremely important because of the concern about zoonotic diseases. And this leads us to the real punchline of your book, which is that we need to be concerned about the fact that diseases do spread from animals to human beings, and that organ transplantation introduces a new risk for ordinary diseases and potentially prion-like diseases like mad cow disease to spread from pigs to humans. And so talk about whether you think this is a real risk and what you propose as a way of controlling that risk.
Great, Jay. Well, that actually relates to the issue of a listener may ask themselves, well, if these miniature transgenic swine hearts have been successfully transplanted into chimpanzees, and the chimpanzees have lived 6 months before actually being put down at government orders, even though they were perfectly healthy and they had their hearts were not giving them any problem, why isn't this being done in people today? Why can't my aunt or my uncle or my grandparent or my parent or my sister receive a heart or a liver or kidney transplant today? And sadly, in my opinion, Jay, the reason is we are afraid of our own fears. And in the year 2001, the world's leading authorities on organ transplantation, the International Organ Transplantation Association, passed a moratorium in which they agreed that no member of this society, which consists of basically all transplant surgeons, would transplant any animal organ into a person until a set of conditions were met. And key among these conditions was that it was proven that there was absolutely no risk of a animal virus passing from a animal organ into a person, the so-called zoonotic virus, as you referred to it. And it's a true example of what's called the precautionary principle taken to extreme, because it's almost impossible to prove that there is no risk. And in fact, there is a risk. There's always a risk of harm in any undertaking. And hence, we ourselves have hamstrung ourselves from saving the lives of all the people dying from organ failure because of a self-imposed fear that we might create another HIV type of pandemic through organ transplantation. Now, I would be the first to say that nobody wants anything vaguely near an HIV epidemic or anything close to it. But we should also realize that with over 100,000 people dying each day from heart failure, that we are already in the teeth of a terrible epidemic of preventable death. And hence, it's not an example of risking something for nothing. We're risking something for a great deal. Now, that takes us to a question of analyzing, well, what exactly is the risk? And it turns out that before this moratorium was passed, a number of studies had been done in which porcine pancreatic islet cells were transplanted into human patients whose pancreas was no longer functioning, and they were basically facing a death sentence from out-of-control diabetic type of condition. And none of these patients developed any viruses, were found to have any viruses as a result of these porcine transplants. In the field, there is a fear of what's called a PERV, P-E-R-V, which stands for porcine endogenous retrovirus. And what this means is that this is a kind of virus that is not actually an existing virus, because it's quite possible, as everyone has agreed, to breed pigs that are free of all known viruses that could harm humans. That's the easy problem. The easy problem has been solved. The hard problem is that within the pig genome, there are what might be called virtual viruses. There is a genetic coding for viruses which can emanate under appropriate conditions, be expressed from the porcine genome under appropriate conditions. And the question is, can you breed these endogenous retroviruses out of the pig genome? Well, impossible. In theory, you can. Nobody has done that yet, and it's a hard problem. But the point remains, though, that the fact that there are some of these PERVs expressed in the pancreatic islet cells transplanted into human patients has never caused any illness whatsoever in any of the transplantees. So finally, what my book does propose is it says, let's bend over backwards to address this concern by imposing a tax on each organ transplant from a animal into a human, and that the purpose of this tax is to fund an international xenotransplantation authority, which would have two main missions. One, it would certify xenograft programs worldwide to ensure not only that the pigs were treated ethically, but also that the operations were being done in a way that was not putting the human blood pool at risk of pig viruses. And secondly, that this organization would perform a global public health function that would continually serve as a sentinel or monitor for animal viruses seeping into the human blood pool, if you will, and at the same time provide basic health care in places where such health care is most lacking. And I believe through these two areas of functionality, the International Xenotransplantation Authority could reduce the risk of an animal virus leaping on a transplanted organ into humans to an absolute de minimis level, and thereby allow xenotransplantation to address the huge death toll that we face today from organ failure.
Well, what I think is so interesting about the proposal is that there's such a global awareness now through avian flu and SARS and AIDS that we need to have global infectious disease monitoring, that we need to have a global electronic system to immediately identify suspicious outbreaks of diseases and have active countermeasures to, you know, in place, ready to go. And this feeds into that, you know, that this would be yet another reason because we could have this global good of curing all these people who have organ failures if we had sufficient disease monitoring in place to catch any of the potential side effects. But otherwise, you're saying people have to die because they might get sick.
Exactly. And the problem with the current effort that's so focused on the avian flu is that it ignores the fact that the people who are most likely to harbor and incubate problematic viruses are people that have basically no access to the healthcare system. And indeed, I would say this is one of the, you know, fundamental lessons learned from the natural epidemiology of the HIV pandemic, that HIV percolated and boiled and grew in populations that had no effective access to health care whatsoever. And then we think that, well, we're going to catch the avian flu, you know, at airports and whatnot, where people pass who in general do have access to the health care system. But in fact, if we want to do an effective job of preventing new pandemics, every human being is an important person to receive basic health care, not only for the intrinsic human rights aspect of that most basic of needs of some form of human health care, but also because each human being is a possible initial vector of some type of either transgenic virus or just a normal zoonotic virus like the avian flu that happens all the time.
Martin, it's an extremely important book, and it's a wonderfully futuristic vision. And I think that as the pace of social technological change comes upon us, people will increasingly see these kinds of proposals as logical. The book is Your Life or Mine, How Geoethics Can Resolve the Conflict Between Public and Private Interests in Xenotransplantation. And I've been speaking with Martin Rothblatt, bioethicist, attorney, futurist, and a very important thinker. So thank you for joining us, Martin.
Thank you so much, Jay, for the interview and for your ongoing Change Surfer radio station. It's a great way for all of us throughout the world to keep up with what we need to know to survive into the future.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.